free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, where you can see a past lineup of speakers, download some past shows, see what's coming down the pike. You'll see that today, August 18, 2008, we have as our guest Damon Kuhn. He's a COO of Ron Motors. They have a car called the Scorpion. It's one of these supercars. And they are making history by being the first car company to implement as part of the factory-built car a hydrogen boost technology. This is green technology that has been largely relegated to tinkerers and garage mechanics who are adding these electrolysis units to vehicles to then vent the or duct the hydroxy gas into the air intake to effect a more efficient burn of the fuel through a catalytic process that the hydrogen seems to bring about in the fuel, increasing the mileage by 20 to 40%. And here's a supercar that is implementing that technology, taking it from hydro runners. They have an onboard electrolysis unit for commercial sale, and they are licensing that out and making some modifications. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. We thank you for joining us, Damon.
Thank you.
Well, tell us that, you know, give... I gave my explanation of what's going on here. Maybe you could give it from your perspective as to how this works, what's going on with this hydrogen boosting technology in the vehicle.
Sure. One thing I need to correct, though, just so we don't have any misinformation, and I think our guys probably should have mentioned it to you the other day, but I guess they didn't. The hydro runner technology, we didn't have adequate time to really test that, and we're actually using our own system at this point that we're developing. We're going to more of a, we like to call it a total systems approach. We've got the hydrolysis unit itself, as far as the tank and things, is, a variation that everybody, has pretty much got the same thing. The unit itself is not really anything highly technical. The key to these things is the controls that are used to integrate it in the engine and make them perform properly. And one of the things that we noticed early on is that most everybody's not using any real pre- or post-production systems to try to help any of this out. What I mean by that is, everybody's, from the tinkerers, and there are a few companies out there that are doing similar things with add-on units, and most of them are, I've got the EFIE controllers and O2 modification units and things like this. Some of them are using the pulse width modulators to, try to control the amperage in most cases. But nobody's really doing anything to enhance the processes. One of the things we've seen is with turbochargers in particular, or any real kind of a forced air system, you can increase your efficiencies. And if you draw, for example, the water off of the air conditioning system and use that to refill your water reservoir, it's probably not a real big point, but if you don't have to fill it up so often, it'll help. That's probably one of the large differences in ours, is the way the electronics work and the fact that we're going to be using several processes to try to make the entire system more efficient rather than just adding the hydrogen and then saying, okay, there it is.
And when you talk about drawing the water off the AC, you're talking about a distillation process where when somebody, I pull a car into a parking spot after driving it on a hot day, you get a pool of water underneath the car from the condensation off that cold system drips onto the pavement below, and you're just saying gather that condensation and use that to refill water tank for the hydrolysis unit.
Yes, and it probably is not going to replace everything we use. Now, we do have a couple of other proprietary systems. One of them has to do with the intercoolers on the turbos. I'm not really at liberty to say exactly what's on there at this point, but, you know, it will also produce some water. It's probably enough to extend our range over most of the commercially available units, 50% or so over what they've got as far as refills, which is minor and has nothing to do with the efficiency of the actual burn process or fuel mileage, but it's one less thing you have to do.
Right. Now, with all of these systems in place, what kind of range or what kind of time between refilling the water are we talking about? Every tank or every other tank, every four tanks?
No, it'd be at least four tanks. Obviously depending on, if we're talking about the Scorpion itself, probably more like 8 to 10 tanks. We've got a 1 gallon system and then a 2 gallon reserve on board, and then we're going to be, like we were talking about, recollecting, what we can off the engine, and refilling it to some degree. So I would say, easily 8 to 10 tanks between fill-ups.
Uh-huh. Now, what about the winter when you're not going to be using the AC?
Well, you're not going to be using the AC for the car, but we do have, without going into things that we're still waiting on patent confirmation and things on, the intercooler for the turbos will be a similar system to what you might see for air conditioning on a normal car for the passengers, in order to boost, the efficiency of the air charge going in, and that will still, condensate during the winter.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a second about the car itself, not about the hydrogen system. It's a sleek-looking, sexy-looking car. At what kind of speed are we talking about, 0 to 60 and top speed? I mean, 0 to 60 in how many seconds, and what's the top speed that you're achieving?
Well, right now, we haven't been able to get it to top speed in all of our testing just yet for a variety of reasons. So there's ongoing engineering. We've had it over 180 mile an hour. It's projected to do 208, and that's probably somewhat conservative, but I'd rather be conservative than announce we're going to do, 350 and do 150, so. 0 to 60, depending on the gearing, we're looking at, probably 3.5 to 4 seconds, depending on gearing and options. Should be, along the lines of most of the cars in the category we're trying to be, competing with, I guess, for lack of better terminology.
Now, in that price range, of course, you're in a more rarefied market. The $150,000 price tag is going to be out of the range of most practical applications. It's going to be people who are looking for, more of the image and the, a place to burn their money after their tennis match. So how many models are you planning on producing? Is there a target there?
Well, yeah, we've got a second model on the drawing board that'll be targeted a little bit more towards it. It's still not going to be a $20,000 car, but targeted more in the family car, off the top of my head, maybe in the, Lexus Jaguar range, somewhere in that neighborhood. People ask us a lot of, why did you build a $150,000 car? People that buy a $150,000 car don't care what gas costs. But part of the point here is if you go on the internet or just about anywhere else, there's very, very little valid information about the HHO technology or, many of the others that people are working with. A $150,000 car, the people that buy these are going to buy it whether the economy is good or not, and in that way we can legitimize this. And we do have intentions of making this technology available to, everybody. That's the whole idea.
Mm-hmm. Now, talking about that for a minute, that's really the primary pioneering step that you're taking here, which is what caught our interest, where you're producing a vehicle that is basically legitimizing a field that has been somewhat in the fringes. And here you are, a major, or you're an automobile manufacturer with many years of experience in the automobile industry between those. I think you have, 30 years in the industry, and Ron has quite a few himself. And, you know, you're no spring chickens to this industry, and here you are implementing what has been a somewhat marginalized technology. You don't see GM picking up this technology. You don't see Toyota, Ford, or any of the other big manufacturers jumping on this, and yet here you are with a high-end car implementing a technology, giving the technology the legitimacy of your reputation, and I think that's very noble of you.
Well, I appreciate that, but the big three, for example, or any large manufacturer, I mean, just the logistics involved for them to try to bring anything to market, you know, this technology has been around, as you know, for, you know, years and years and years, but like anything else, until people are driven to do something, they don't. Now with gas prices and things the way they are, now people are taking an interest, but myself and Ron both have been through the patent process and trying to get things into major manufacturers, and it's near impossible to take them something, even if it's proven to work. It just doesn't work that way anymore, and that's part of the point behind this, is to be able to, you know, okay, fine, you don't want to do it. We are an auto manufacturer now. We'll do it.
Ron told me when I was talking to him the other day, he said, we got tired of being turned down by the big three automobile companies, so we decided to build our own company.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, personally, my observation, you know, I look around on the Internet, obviously, you know, quite a bit, looking to see what people are doing with this type of technology. And there's a lot of people out there who probably are not legitimate, to be nice about it, but there's quite a few out there who do have things that work. We've had them drive up here and seen two or three things that, you know, they had proven and you could see it work, but they don't have the backing or the resources or reputation to be able to do anything with it, and that's part of what we're about too, where, you know, people come in here and, when, you know, by appointment we entertain ideas from just about anybody, and you'd be surprised how much technology is out there that just, you know, there's no way for people to get it to market.
Yeah.
So, you know, we intend to incorporate quite a bit. I mean, the hydrogen thing is what's caught most people's attention, but this car, like I said, is going to be a total systems approach, and we've got technology on the drawing board for the second one and beyond that is probably equally as interesting once we get that far.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about the hydrogen injection, typically in these things you see on the net, people are running both the hydrogen and the oxygen gas commonly ducted through one tube into the air intake. Are you separating the hydrogen and oxygen, or are you running them together?
That's a good question, and the best answer I got for you right at the minute is yes. We've actually got two different ways of doing it. I'm leaning towards separating for... you're asking questions I can't go all the way into, but the same thing I was talking about before, the pre- and post-production processing. People have talked about heating the mixture as they're doing electrolysis and cooling it, and tried several different things to make the process more efficient, and not that there aren't some benefits there, possibly, but if you split the gases and do some processing after the fact, I believe we can make it quite a bit more efficient than just ducting it straight in, but we haven't completely finished our testing on that. But I'm leaning towards doing a simple answer to separating it.
There is a safety consideration. A member of our New Energy Congress, Ty Robinson, is always harping on us regarding these hydroxy technology. He says that the German name for this is canal gas, K-N-A-L-L, which stands for boom gas. because you, in separating and electrolyzing out the hydrogen and oxygen, you have a perfect steel chemoelectric mixture of hydrogen and oxygen to then recombine. And you don't even have to have a spark to do it. Sometimes it'll just recombine and you'll have an instantaneous or a non-spark induced explosion on your hand. And it also has a very high propagation speed. And so people will put flame arresters and or flash arresters and bubblers and whatnot to prevent the flame from going back into the hydrolysis unit to have an explosion in that and cause damage to the engine or injure people if the hood is open. Have you weighed some of those factors in determining whether you're going to split the isolate the hydrogen oxygen or whether you're going to have it run in as a separate species?
Well, that was part of the consideration originally for splitting it, but to be fair, before, you know, anybody starts going down the other path, if you've got pure oxygen or pure hydrogen, you can also create yourself some problems, obviously. I'm not going to say that either way is necessarily that much more of a safety factor than the other. However, I mean, there's ways around this. Most of what you see, in all fairness, are people who have rather limited resources as far as, you know, what's available to work with. A bubbler, you know, is very common, and there's nothing wrong with that, but there's some ultra-high-speed one-way valves that are fairly commonly available if you've got access to buying things like that. They can be incorporated, and we've also got two or three controls on there for, you've seen the thermal controls, obviously, for people to, you know, pull the current down. Ours is designed a little differently to vary the amount of, for lack of a better way to explain it, to be the amount of plates that are utilized at any given point. For example, you know, at idle you may not need quite the volume you would at a higher throttle setting. So, you know, if we're going to talk about conserving energy, why be pumping hydrogen through there you don't need? But it also ties into another circuit that's basically a shutdown circuit. If it sees a large pressure rise, and large meaning 5 to 7 PSI over normal, it immediately shuts the system down for two reasons. One is for controlling the mixture, similar to what a lot of people use in the pulse width machines for. The other one being a safety, you know, extra safety feature. And it is tied to a circuit breaker, so somebody who was intent on making sure it, you know, kept running even though they had the warning light, you can't do that without stopping the car and taking the fuse box apart. So we've, short answer, we've incorporated several other safety controls. And to be real blunt about it, you're talking about a very small amount of this mixture properly ducted and properly utilized. It's as safe as anything else. It's not like you're carrying around 200 pounds of this stuff in an open lighter.
Yeah.
So, you know, I acknowledge there are some safety concerns, but, you know, handled properly with that thought in mind, I don't think you're looking at any more danger than, you know, anything else we play with on a daily basis.
Since this is a production car, I imagine you've got the same kind of hurdles, even though it's a supercar, you've got the same hurdles to make this thing street-worthy as any other person, so they're going to be facing carb testing and other kinds of testing to get this thing on the road. In adding this component to the vehicle, do you see that obstacle being quite a bit higher or just a little bit higher than what you would be facing otherwise?
We've already talked to all the different agencies, and you know, you're correct. I mean, we're going to be going through the same certifications that any OE would, and we've had preliminary discussions, obviously, before we get the thing, you know, all the way built, find out we can't do anything with it. They're going to do some testing, but quite honestly, the safety issues we've already pretty well handled just in talking and showing, you know, their representatives what we've got here. In all honesty, they're more concerned with the emissions than they are with the safety. So, it's, I don't see it as being a big hurdle, no.
Yeah, you're not going to have to be worrying about emissions with this car.
No, I don't think so.
Because that's one of the things that this hydrogen boosting does, is it really cleans up the emissions along with giving you more efficiency of the fuel. You talked earlier about one of the things that you don't see in some of these systems that float around the net is any kind of controlling on the input. And you talked a little bit later, just a few minutes ago, about how, you know, you have a governing of the engine. You've got idle speed, and then you've got full throttle and everything in between. And most of the systems online are basically producing a fixed amount of hydroxy gas from the battery. It's set at a certain level, and it just, as long as the engine or the ignition's turned on, it's producing gas at a fixed rate. And you're saying what you want to be able to do is to throttle that rate of flow so it's low at idle and high at high throttle. And I'm wondering if you're going to be, you talked about doing some things with the electrodes. Are you also going to be doing anything on the ducting end of it so that you're increasing or decreasing the flow and maybe have a reservoir somewhere so you can draw from the reservoir rather than from the system on the fly?
No, I'm pretty sure I need to hire you. That's exactly what we're doing. The ducting, and there is, and I suppose this is going to take us right back to the safety issue. There's a small reservoir, basically just to make up for the time lag. It's not very big, but that's exactly how you would do some of it. Now, it's not altogether necessary in all modes, more so if you're at an idle for a prolonged period is really the only time that we've seen that you're going to run into this, providing you've got, you know, enough of a volume in your electrolyzer to begin with to handle the size of an engine you're applying it to. So, short answer, yeah, there is some ducting and reservoir things. There's also a, most people are reading either off the map or off the O2 or the wideband sensor, and most of them are not taking advantage of any other sensors on the car, meaning, say, wheel speed. If the car knows you're sitting there at a stoplight, for example, sitting still for a minute, you can program some things in, if you sit and think about it, to be able to sort of, now it's kind of, the things you buy to speed up your internet connection, where they cache things on the internet, you can, in a manner of speaking, cache some hydrogen if you can anticipate that you're going to need it.
What about controlling the voltage, having some kind of a regulator so that you're increasing and decreasing the input energy on the electrolysis end of things?
Yeah. That part of what we're doing, the patent process, is not far enough along for me to openly talk about it, but you're going the right direction, not quite exactly the same process we're using, but we are controlling the energy going in, yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little different than what you're talking about, and that being one of the major parts that makes us different that I can't just talk about just yet.
One thing I might mention, my associate, Ty Robinson of intergalactichydrogen.com, he converts vehicles to run on clean fuels, hydrogen, natural gas, ethanol, etc., as well as still run on the fuel that they were made to run on, gasoline or diesel.
Mm-hmm.
And he has actually done quite a bit of testing since he has a vehicle that runs on hydrogen, and he's got these tanks in the back of his truck to then run the hydrogen into his engine to burn as his primary fuel. He's also played around with ducting that hydrogen in at a given rate to match the rate at which the fuel is being burned, the gasoline or diesel. And it is the hydrogen that is responsible for the burning, for the catalytic effect to increase the efficiency of the fuel. And it's not just a matter of increasing efficiency so you get more miles per gallon. You also are increasing your torque. You're increasing your horsepower because you're getting more bang for your buck. And I would imagine that that's part of your motivation in implementing this technology in a supercar, is because it is giving you more muscle per gallon burned.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm an old hot rodder. That's more power is more better.
Yeah. And so it makes sense from that perspective that that it's a technology that you'd be interested in as, you know, implementing this into a muscle car of some kind. But the point I wanted to make is that it's not the hydroxy gas that's the magical ingredient. It's the hydrogen in that gas that's the magical ingredient that has the catalytic properties. That was shown by Ty Robinson. So if you do separate out the oxygen, you're also getting rid of the problems you have of having to adjust your O2 sensor and having to override stuff and kind of supersede what the engine's wanting to do, because it sees a lean mixture or a rich mixture, depending on how you're running this, and you've got to then trick it to do certain things so that it won't fight against you, whereas if you're just running the hydrogen in there, you don't have the same problem.
And I think you need to stop talking on the radio and just come down here.
Well, we like
to
burn the well.
We've talked about a lot of these things that I don't know if people don't notice it or if it's just, you know, the people who do have the money and the exposure to do something have chosen not to. And I don't have the answer to that, but, you know, that's, you're running right down the exact same line we're going.
Yeah. I'm curious, what is the ratio that you've found? Because I would imagine, let's take my friend's situation where he's got a hydrogen tank on board with basically an unlimited amount of hydrogen, comparatively speaking, to dump in to catalyze the fuel to make it burn more efficiently, to give you more power per amount of fuel you're burning. I'd be curious to see some kind of a graph to show where your optimal mixture is at and what you're going to want to target in terms of supplementing with this catalytic effect. At one point, I would imagine the hydrogen is actually just turning into fuel as opposed to being serving as a catalyst. And at that point, you want to, you know, stop adding it as a catalyst and use your primary fuel as the fuel. Have you done any tests along those lines to see what is the optimal point of how much hydrogen gas you want to be injecting along with the burning of your regular fuel?
Well, we have, and to be blatantly honest, and it's probably not exactly the answer you're looking for, we haven't finished that testing. And one of the reasons, I thought it would be a fairly linear progression, you know, based on engine size and power requirement, loading, RPM, you know, fairly standard conditions. It doesn't seem to work quite that way from what I'm seeing so far. We've got some cylinder temperature sensors and things like this, some fairly sophisticated equipment I used in race engine building to try to monitor what's going on in there. And you're kind of, well, to give you a figure, we're kind of hanging around 34% now under a load, and that load being obviously our car on a dyno, which would be a different load than you might see on a V8 in a bigger truck. But it doesn't seem to necessarily follow the path that you would think it would if you do it mathematically, say just using any fuel, gasoline or methane or whatever. And typically you can say, okay, it uses this many pounds an hour and be fairly close mathematically. It doesn't seem to necessarily follow that from what I'm seeing right at the minute. It does until you get into a variable load situation. Not everybody runs down the road with their foot in exactly the same place all day long. Most drivers, from my observations, are not quite that, well, they're a little erratic, I guess, you know, with the throttle. And when you start doing that, at least with the sensors that exist on most production cars now, the controls are not fast enough, is what I think we're seeing, to give adequate feedback. But short answer, around 34% is where we're kind of seeing the cut line.
I would imagine with that number that, you know, you're talking about onboard electrolysis, and to be able to generate as much fuel as you need on board, I would imagine the number of that you could feasibly produce on the fly would be closer to somewhere below 10%, wouldn't it?
It hovers around 10 to 12%. It was about, you know, next thing I was going to say. You know, what are you? what's optimum and what can be produced in a reasonable manner right at the minute is part of what we're still working on.
And that's under normal running conditions. I was watching a little segment. Jay Leno was testing this Shelby supercar that has a 32-gallon tank in it that can take it 600 miles unless you're putting pedal to the metal, in which case it's dumping 1 gallon per 15 seconds of fuel.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's really going through the fuel. And I would imagine where, you know, yours is a supercar as well, you know, with the pedal to the metal scenario where somebody really wants to get some throttle going, that, you know, you're not going to be able to keep up with that on your hydrogen production. So you basically just give it what you can, but the rest of it's going to have to come from the fuel.
Exactly. And we've got probably 7 or 8 different things that we're doing right now, but, you know, we're kind of on a production schedule, obviously, and need to get the cars out there. The first ones, you know, just like anybody else, is not going to be the optimum, you know, kind of like the Model T and what we got now. It's not going to be absolute when it first rolls out of here, but I believe within about the next 6 months, we're going to have quite a bit more production capability, and then a few other things that you know, we're still working on. This has all happened a lot quicker than what we expected. So there's work yet to be done. I think we've got, I mean, we're not going to get 40 miles a gallon doing 208 mile an hour, but I think you can go down the highway and get that.
Yeah, that's really quite amazing to see. You know, usually you see a muscle car, you're picturing that its mileage is not something they're after, and yet here you've got a car getting the sticker mileage, so to speak, surpasses most of the standard vehicles out on the road.
Well, that's the idea, and if we can take that technology and apply it, for example, to the pickup trucks that nobody can sell right now and get those to do something reasonably decent, well, that might help everybody else.
Well, and that goes back to another question that I wanted to ask early on when you made a comment about, you know, you're implementing this technology into this car, and one of your motivations is basically to set an example. And you're basically limiting yourself to, in terms of your own production, to, you know, race car or sports car types of vehicles. But are you going to license the hydrogen end of things, the hydroxy boost or the hydrogen boost end of things? Are you going to license that out to other manufacturers to use in their systems once you prove it to be, you know, roadworthy, practical, something that makes sense in a production vehicle?
Well, we actually have been in talks, and we do have intentions of licensing the technology. May or may not go to manufacturers because of the, you know, same things we've faced in the past. Now that we are an OE, then, you know, maybe they will pay attention to us, maybe they won't. But there's other ways to get it out there for people, and it really is a lot of the intention is to, you know, the guys, again, that drive $150,000 cars, you know, probably aren't particularly concerned. That may not sound good, but they can afford the $5 a gallon or whatever. The people who need the help are driving, you know, a pickup truck or a, you know, a Toyota or a Cadillac or whatever. We'll make it available for those people is one of the main intents here of the whole project.
And I really appreciate that because, you know, from my vantage point, we're looking at these technologies all the time, and there are just a ton of people out there chasing this right now. Some of them just in their backyard and their garage. Others, you know, trying to come up with things that they can sell. And there's not really a lot out there that we can point to and say, here's the one you want to go with. You know, there's some companies that are better than others that we feel more comfortable recommending. But I don't see anything out there available right now that I would feel comfortable saying, this is absolutely the best technology. It's a great company. You're going to get great support, great warranty, you know, the whole package deal. It's a great company that does great business. There's nothing out there right now that we can point to. It's very kind of chaotic almost right now with the number of people chasing it, trying different things. There's not a lot of science involved to say, well, what is the optimal system? Where do you want the controls? And what is going to give you the best system altogether for the best price? It sounds like you may be coming up, because you've got more resources to be able to ask those questions and answer them scientifically, you're going to be in a good position to come up with a product that, it, you know, it might not be something your company produces, but it could be something you license out for somebody else to take and run with.
No, exactly. I mean, we both come from an automotive background, and, you know, obviously are people who like to tinker with things. But, you know, most of these, you know, just to be blunt, there's a lot of people out there on the Internet that are selling things that don't work, and, you know, they're just there to make a dollar. There's a lot of guys out there that, in my opinion, have things that probably do work that just don't have the, like I said, backing or funding or whatever it may be to get their product to the market, and there's a complete lack of any, you know, valid testing by anybody, you know, that anybody knows. You put it in a car like this and, you know, pick some famous person that makes you kind of money to buy one of these, says, yeah, I've been driving around for a year and it really does work. Well, then we can get some legitimate testing done, and then we have every intention of taking it to, a third party testing arena that's already been set up once we've got it the way we want it, and, get some legitimate testing done to where somebody can get on the Internet and go, well, does it work or doesn't it, and what's the actual results? And it's not the company trying to sell the product. It'll be an independent test that's verifiable.
And this would then be a product that would be a retrofit to any existing vehicle, whether it's diesel or gasoline. You could, you know, they might actually come out with, you know, give me the make and model of the car you want, and we'll give you the X unit because it fits inside, you know, this one's too big for you, this one will fit in your car, you just put it over here on this side of the engine. Because that's one of the problems you run into with a one-size-fits-all design, is that the engine compartment is so different from one car to another. There's so many variables in an engine. So, you know, there really needs to be a well-financed company to take this technology and run with this retrofit thing, that you can take the existing infrastructure, the existing automobiles and trucks out there, to be able to sell them a unit that they can put on their car in an afternoon that will, you know, give them, you know, 20-40% more mileage for their dollar.
Well, that's exactly what we're looking at, and that's the intent. And, you know, we've had comments, and I'm sure you heard them also with, you know, people talking about, well, why in the world do you want to put hydrogen with gasoline? It's, you know, why are you doing it with an IC engine? And, you know, let's go electric, let's do this and that. And, you know, this is meant to be a long-term interim solution, and like I said, we're working on other technologies, but the infrastructure for, say, the tank type of vehicles now, and the fuel cells and the electric cars and things, they're just not an infrastructure there. I suppose it'd work fine if you live in, you know, New York City and you're driving 5 miles to work and 5 miles home. But, for example, sitting here in Texas, I drive 150 miles at a time. You know, a car like that, if you run out of hydrogen in LaGrange, Texas, what are you going to do? So we're trying to develop something that will get people, you know, what they need right now while we're, you know, working on even better technology is the whole intent.
Well, one of the things that's nice about this hydrogen boost technology is it also works with biodiesel, for example, or some of the alternate, you know, there's one of the companies that we've been featuring in our top 100 is Green Power Inc. up in Washington, and they're turning waste into diesel. Mm-hmm. Through a proprietary catalytic process, and they're going commercial right now. They're, you know, selling completed units for municipalities to install, and this is not biodiesel. This is high grade diesel, the same as what you might get from crude, and even better actually. And the hydrogen boost is going to increase its efficiency, and so there are ways to clean up our fuel so that all our alternate fuels are basically replacing the fossil-based fuels, and this hydrogen boost will, you know, give even more bang for the buck, so to speak. So It is a technology, as you say, it is a long-term interim technology. It's not something that's going to get us past the next 2-3 years. It's going to be 10 to 20 years before this technology becomes obsolete.
Yeah, that's our thinking. There's several, like you say. I've been kind of watching a couple of the companies with the methane technology and a similar process to the producing the diesel, and that's, you know, again, something if somebody wanted to do it on their own, is just about something you could do at your house. There's more than one way to do a hybrid.
Yeah. Well, let's talk for a minute about the business end of things on your company. You've got a prototype you've been running, and you're going to be, isn't there something coming up in Vegas where you're going to be demonstrating a couple of vehicles?
Actually, they've kind of, for lack of a better term, scooped us on them. We were about to, and we probably still will, put a press release out, but the people at SEMA apparently figured that out before we did and put out a press release over the weekend. We're actually going to be on the stage with the DuPont Registry at SEMA with probably one car at this point, possibly two, but definitely one.
When's that going to be?
That, I believe, is November 2nd. I wouldn't quote me on that, but it should be within a day or so. Be at the SEMA show.
And those will be fully functional vehicles?
Yes, sir. Yeah. We're actually shipping the chassis out to California tomorrow to begin putting the body on that particular car.
Now, do you actually have a prototype that's got the body on it yet, or is that, if I understand right, that you haven't gone that step yet?
No, I wanted to do the high-speed testing and the handling testing and things. I mean, I know that most everybody's interest in this at this point probably revolves more around the hydrogen, but I wanted to make sure it would still do what a supercar is supposed to do. This is a proprietary suspension. Well, it's a double wishbone. I mean, it's not an unusual suspension, but some of the sizing is different and it's custom, and I was looking for some particular things out of the handling. So before we finalize the exterior dimensions of the chassis, I needed to do the high-speed runs before they completed the body molding. So we just got that done about a week and a half ago. So short answer, no, we don't have the body on it yet, and that was basically delayed so that I could make sure the chassis was the way it was supposed to be before they had to remake out the body.
The engine's in the back of the car?
Yes, sir. It's a mid-engine design.
So those fins, or I'm not sure what you call the openings in the car in front of the back wheel, that's the air intake for the engine cooling system, or the air intake?
It serves that purpose along with, it'll help cool the brakes. It also has a little bit to do with the aerodynamics, but a large part of it is, yes, for engine cooling.
When you build a design like this, do you run it through wind tunnel tests?
Yes, sir. It'll go through full wind tunnel testing, finite element analysis. Can't talk today. All of your standard testing, we'll put it on the G-pad. I mean, everything that you see done to a car, and probably a few things a lot of people don't do, we will do. I intend to be driving around in one of these myself, and I'm a little particular about it. You know, if I decide I want to get a ticket, I want to make sure I can run 208 down the highway without ending up in a ditch. So we'll be doing quite a few things to make sure that it does a little bit more than what it needs to do. But wind tunnel testing is scheduled for early next year to finalize a couple of things, mainly to do with the rear wing. Most everything else has already been under analysis, so
is that
there'll be some minor changes, but nothing to speak of.
Is the wind tunnel test on a scale model, or full? Is it like quarter scale or smaller?
What we've got right now is quarter scale and quite a bit of computer modeling. A lot of it's done that way now. There's a couple of areas that you can't really simulate, and a scale model won't work very well on, and that's what we're going to have to put the full scale in. That's part of the reason for the estimated top speed. We can actually make one go somewhat faster than that. But until I see whether or not we've got to change a couple of things, and these will be very, very minor things that you probably won't be able to necessarily see, but we may have to change a few things to go any faster than that.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about the supercars, I'm not, you know, really familiar with that industry. I've come across a couple recently, so I've got a little bit of exposure. I'm certainly not an expert in that area. I'm curious, what are the selling points for your model over others in the industry? If you go up $620, you can buy that Shelby supercar, and it goes 240-plus miles an hour. It's got the world record right now for speed. You know, where you're, you know, quite a ways under that speed-wise, but you're also a lot cheaper, $150,000. What are your primary selling points? Are you targeting a specific price point with a particular speed and performance? What are the things that you're basically putting on your brochure, so to speak?
Well, I mean, at the exact price point we're at, around $150, there's really not a lot there, to be honest. Most of them that are anywhere in this range as far as performance are more on the $200 to $250 range, and then down below this are not quite the same thing. There's quite a few of them considerably faster, but none of those get 40 miles a gallon. They still pollute the atmosphere as bad or worse than anything else on the road. They're extreme high maintenance costs, mainly because a lot of it's proprietary on a lot of these cars, and not necessarily the Shelby, but say a Ferrari or a Lotus, Lamborghini. You know, you got to call Helmut to come get your car and take it to his place halfway across the country to fix it when it breaks. Everything with the exception of the chassis itself and a couple of the A-arm parts on this car is something you can get in just about anywhere in the country. It's the Acura engine, the turbochargers are Ray J's, or you can use any of the T3 turbos. Most everything on the car you could turn into your nearest Acura dealer or even most general mechanics and get it fixed without having to pay $6,000 every time the thing breaks down and then wait around for a month to get your car back. That's probably one of the primary points.
So basically you're getting a $250,000 equivalent car for almost half that, and a lot less maintenance, a lot more of a practical vehicle with still a lot of the muscle.
Exactly. And to be fair, some of the $250,000 ones have a little bit fancier suspension and things, but they won't outrun this, and this will go around the corner as well as they will. And to me, if you got a $500,000 car, well, maybe you don't care if it's gone for a month while you drive your other three. But $150,000 car, I mean, this is made to drive. Like I said, I want one, and I don't want to be confined to driving it 8 miles and park it and get my Cadillac and go to the next 200.
Mm-hmm.
So serviceability, I think, is one of the prime ones.
Mm-hmm. When are you going to be in production?
We're projecting first quarter of 2009. We originally had some projections for 2008, but that was before they wanted us to be at SEMA and do a few other things. Should be late first quarter. They should be rolling out of here.
Okay. And what rate are you going to be cranking these out once you start producing?
First year is projected at 200 units, and we'll be ramping up probably over a 3 to 4 year period up to around 500 a year. Obviously depending on orders. That's never going to be 20,000 a year, so far as we know. But it's a fairly limited production car.
Right. When you have somewhat of a limited production car, I would imagine you can't go quite into some of the robotics on the assembly line that you might be able to on a much higher production run. So that's one of the reasons for the higher price tag?
Well, it's part of the reason, and blatantly honest with you, people who buy a $150,000 car expect a little bit of, attention, hand assembled, you know, fitted pieces, things that you're not going to get off a robotic line. Not that the robots, you know, probably make less mistakes than humans do, but there's a human element in building a car like this that you, so far they haven't been able to replace with a robot. So I think you're getting a, you know, you're getting a handcrafted piece rather than something that ran down an assembly line. And for whatever that's worth, you know, people who buy these kind of cars, you can expect that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. You say that the innards, the engine is primarily and the Acura.
The one that we've got right now is an Acura VTEC six-cylinder with a proprietary dual turbocharger system on it. That's the 450-horse version. Something we haven't been very public about right now. We're in design stages of a 700-horse-plus version of this, but that's going to require a few modifications to the internal pieces, pistons and things like this on the engine before I'll consider it reliable. So we'll be coming up with something a little better than that, but for now, 450 horses and 2,000 pounds ought to get you around reasonably well.
Uh-huh. Now, one of the things I'm curious from a psyche point of view, you know, as you've mentioned a number of times, talking about the hydrogen-boosting element of this, that is a cutting-edge, bleeding-edge technology that has not been implemented, and here you are implementing it on a $150,000 car. Does that make you nervous at all?
No. We've done quite a bit of testing. And, we're not going to, that's that, you know, in all honesty, is part of the reason for the delay. We had to do a little bit further testing on a couple of things, and I'm happy with it all now. When they go out of here, we want to make sure that, number one, they're safe, obviously, but I also don't want somebody driving back in here, you know, 2 months later going, my car's broke. We want to make sure that when they go out of here, they're as reliable and safe as anything else you can buy. So, no, I'm not nervous in the least.
So, in terms of playing the role of pioneer, do you think it's plausible? I mean, we've addressed this a little bit already, but with the level of stature that you're bringing to this technology, I would think that you're speeding up by several years the amount of time it would have taken otherwise for the big automobile manufacturers, the big three, to take notice of this technology and start implementing some stuff themselves.
Well, that's what we're hoping. Actually, most the reason for doing it. You know, both of us, like I said, have been involved in that end, trying to get people to adopt technology. We've got patents on things that probably could have been used years ago, but, and, you know, for whatever reason, the major manufacturers either can't or won't adopt, and, you know, we don't have another 8 or 10 years to wait around for them to get around to doing something. People need something now. You know, it's neither one of us are multi-gazillionaires either, so we need it too.
Uh-huh. Well, you got your knuckles bloody knocking on their doors, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. That's pretty much figured out, and we've had several people with some pretty good ideas, not necessarily all of them along the lines of what we're doing, you know, show up here because of the same reason, and a lot of them do have things that would help the average American or the average person in the world quite a bit, but you know, the bureaucracy and the, you know, whatever else goes on to keep people from adapting to new technologies, just, you know, got people running around, there's nowhere for them to go, and that's actually part of what we're hoping to be, is somewhere where people can bring us, you know, legitimate new technologies, and maybe we can help them.
Yeah. Well, very good. I appreciate that very much, because we're continually running into really good stuff, and you know, people feel quite hopeless. They've got something great, but who do they take it to? So at least in some regards, Ron Motor Company can be seen as a venting place for the implementation possibly of some of the best technologies. We've come to the end of our segment. I really appreciate you joining us and talking about your car, and what you got there in implementing the hydrogen boost technology, being the first company to do so on a factory level. And we certainly wish you the best as you roll this thing out.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You're certainly welcome. Again, we've been talking to Damon Kuhn. He's the COO of Ron Motors. And your website is?
www.ronmotors.com.
With two N's, R-O-N-N, ronmotors.com. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.